You're listening to the Author Stories Podcast, bringing you the story behind the stories and the storytellers.
Margaret Wise,
Terry Brooks,
Sheena Kamal,
Matthew Quick,
J.T. Ellison,
Walt D. Williams,
Brad Ford,
Corey Doctorow,
Brandon Sanderson,
Robin Mom,
Ernest Klein, Jim Butcher,
Sherilyn Harris.
Visit HankGarner.com for archives of all the shows. Today's guest is
David Baldacci.
Thanks for tuning into Author Stories today. We've got a fantastic show coming up for you. As always, go to HankGarner.com where you can subscribe to the show on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher Radio, Spotify, YouTube, anywhere that you like to get your author interviews, you can find us there. I'd like to thank Aaron St. Pierre and Gwen White today for sponsoring this episode with their book, The Fire Thief. She fights to survive, but only white-hot rage will reveal her true power. Remembering the hope of the past helps Stasha endure her bleak present. Blaming herself for her best friend's injury, she brawls and steals to provide in a world run by Faye. But with an arranged marriage approaching, Stasha swipes two silvers in hope of their escape and erupts into a fiery burst of magic. Surprised and confused by power she can't possibly control, Stasha barely has time to register that her friend has been sent off to die. With time running out and no options left, she must put her faith in powerful strangers as they dive into a Fae skirmish for supremacy. Surrounded by dubious allies, her only hope to redeem her past is to mount an attack on an inescapable death camp. As Stasha fights to free her friend, the battle she's faced her whole life is about to become a war. The Fire Thief is the first book in an exhilarating high fantasy series. If you like gutsy heroines, elemental magic, and epic sword and sorcery action, then you'll love New York Times bestselling authors Aaron St. Pierre and Gwen White's roller coaster tale. Buy The Fire Thief to unlock an ancient fae destiny today. Also thanks to Patrice Fitzgerald and the Beyond the Stars Space Opera Anthology series. There are 5 volumes out, and a 6th one comes out this summer in the Beyond the Stars Space Opera Anthology series. Each release includes between 10 and 15 short stories, followed by a Q&A with the author. Some of the writers are New York Times and USA Today bestsellers. Some readers are saying, it's a blisteringly good collection. These stories are full of great complex characters, not all of them human. Twists and turns and fantastic world building. Epic space battles, exotic aliens, far-flung planets. 15 fabulous tales that will thrill and surprise you, some chosen from previous Beyond the Stars volumes and some brand new, are in the Best Of collection. Come along as these award-winning authors sweep you along on adventures as broad as the universe and as deep as their imagination. The Beyond the Stars Space Opera Anthology series, pick it up today. Stay tuned after the show for a special audiobook clip from C. Stephen Manley's Master of Hounds. Well, thanks for joining me again for the Author Stories Podcast, where I bring you the story behind the stories and the storytellers. Today, I'm really excited to welcome David Baldacci back to the show. He was on a couple of months ago talking about his newest release in the Vega Jane series, his YA fantasy series. And today, his new book, Redemption, the latest in the Memory Man series, is out everywhere and available to purchase right now. Welcome back to the show, David.
Hey, it's great to be back. Thank you.
David, since we talked recently, and we always begin the show with the same question of what is your first memory of wanting to be a writer or storyteller, but we covered that, and we talked all about your mom giving you that journal to shut you up that then turned into an entire writing career. What's your first memory of a mystery or thriller book that really lit your imagination?
I thought there's probably two of them for me. Now, the series that I loved when I was a kid, my parents would buy me one either for my birthday or for Christmas, depending on when the book was out. Everybody knows Hardy Boys, but my series was The Three Investigators, Alfred Hitchcock and The Three Investigators, Jupiter Jones, Pete Crenshaw, and Bob Andrews. And they were just really cool mysteries set in Southern California. and Jupiter Jones was the brains, Pete Crenshaw was the athlete, and Bob Andrews was the studious records kind of guy. And they had this old mobile trailer in this junkyard that Jupiter Jones's uncle and aunt ran. And I love those books. In fact, I love them so much. So, you know, over the years, the books got lost or destroyed or whatever. I went back as an adult, and there's a place online that sells only three investigator books. I bought all the first editions. There's like 45 of them. And I've got them in my home. And I will confess to you that I go back occasionally and pick one up and read them. And it's like being 10 years old again. And just that feeling of, wow, another adventure, you know, the Moaning Cave, you know, and Terror Castle. And it was just, I can't tell you. I know it seems silly. I'm a grown man and all that. But just to crack open that book and relive the joy of what it was like to open a book for the first time and just waiting to be excited and astounded by what was inside, that is just so compelling for me.
I know. What is it about mysteries, do you think, that really get your imagination going?
Well, it's the element of surprise and not knowing. I mean, people in life, they like to, you know, control things for the most part. You know, you want to go to work and you want to feel like you have some control of what's going to go on, what you're going to work on that day. In your family life, you know, you want to have schedules. What are the kids up to? What's going to happen this week? Are we going to go to dinner? Are we visiting somebody or having people over? But with mysteries, you're taken out of that safe, comfortable environment and you're put into a situation where you have no idea what's going to happen when you turn the next page. And you have no idea if somebody's going to, you know, be harmed, somebody's going to die, a body's going to be discovered. There's a clue that, did I pick up on the right clue, you know, for later on I'm going to use? Was that important what that person said? It's like Law and Order, you know, watching a Law and Order episode. I always tell people if you want to figure out who's involved in something in Law and Order, there's the second peak rule. If you have a peripheral character that comes in to convey some information to somebody, you know, the lawyer or cop, or whatever, great. If that person comes back a second time to convey more information, that's the second peak rule, like I call it. Watch that person. that's a dead giveaway. So it was just, I think, the excitement of not being in control of something and not knowing what's going to happen around the corner.
Well, you bring up an excellent point in that, you know, one thing that we have to watch for as writers is using the familiar tropes, but not allowing those to become to not become to the point where the reader can see them coming. Like you've developed a second peep rule, you know.
Right.
How do you dodge those things, especially as many books as you've written? You know, the temptation, it would seem, would be to become formulaic. That would be the easy thing to do. But that's not, you never take the easy way out on stories, because as a reader, you never give me the easy way out. Are there things that you do to watch for things like that?
Yeah, there are. I mean, you can overcomplicate a plot so to such a point that it's so convoluted nobody can follow it. And then some of the pleasure is lost. The reading pleasure is lost because of that. You know, I've read some books where I was kind of like, oh, if it takes you 87 pages to explain what happened at the end, there's a problem. So I try to complicate without obfuscating and making it so confusing that the fun has gone out of it. So in order to do that, you really have to hit your marks precisely. Instead of flooding people with information to try to confuse them and hide what you're trying to do, I try to take one or two points and, you know, drill down way down into the weeds so people have to focus on them, but they're not sure which one is important, which one is not. And not overloading them, but giving them something in great detail, one or two things to focus on. But again, leaving it up to their own judgment as to what is important and what is not important. So that's really how I go about it. And little things along the way, you know, particularly for Amos Decker, he's a memory man. He remembers things. So it's usually small things that trip up criminals. You know, they get the big details right and they blow it on the little details. You can listen to Forensic Files. I tell people, again, if you're thinking about committing a crime, listen to Forensic Files, because you know you're not going to get away with it. you think you've cleansed the crime scene, but no, they come in with luminol and, you know, you use bleach. Don't use bleach. You know, use a detergent that has air bubbles in it. It's the only way to get rid of the blood content and the DNA source. So, but most people don't know that, right? So it's the little details that I try to have my characters focus on, and then the reader has to focus on them as well. They just don't know sometimes what those little details mean to my detectives. What are they taking out of it? Because a reader might take something entirely different out of a scene than my detective like Amos Decker does. So really, it takes a lot of work to get that right, where you can complicate without confusing people in a bad sense. And then at the end, as the writer, I don't want to spend 80 pages explaining, because if I have to spend 80 pages at the end explaining what the plot was all about and how the person solved it, then I really failed as a storyteller, because all of that should have been laid out throughout the entire story already. And at the end, I could have, a few page wrap up and, to point out some obvious conclusions and things they might not have gotten. But that needs to be in the story, not all at the end.
Right. Speaking of characters, that you mentioned, you have written some of the most fascinating, engaging characters in fiction. We've got Amos Decker that we're talking about today in Redemption. King and Maxwell, the Puller, Roby, Shaw, and even in your fantasy series with Jane. How do you know when a character is a winner for you? And do these characters just come out of the ether? Are they inspired by real people? How do these people usually come to you?
It's usually, something about what they do for a living or some element of them that I find interesting. I'll give you I know quite a few Secret Service agents, and the King and Maxwell series, they were both former Secret Service agents, and they screwed up. It was a minimal mistake, but in the Secret Service, there's no room for error. So you blow it one time, you're out. And so having talked to some Secret Service agents and understanding the pressure they're under made me think about, well, what if I have two really good agents, but they screwed up one time only, and now they're both out, and they have to do something else with their lives? What might that be? And what if they came together because there was an event that happened to both of them that might have a connection? And that was born King and Maxwell. With Amos Decker, it was like, I wonder, I'd read a book called Born on a Blue Tuesday about somebody who had a traumatic brain injury like Decker did, and they came out of it with two conditions, hyperthymesia, perfect recall like he has, and synesthesia, which he also has, which is the commingling of your sensory pathways in your brain such that smell and sound and all that are commingled. And people who have that might see numbers and colors, for instance. So I read that book and I was fascinated. I said, the brain is just, we don't understand any more about the brain in 2019 than we did in 1919. So I just went after that. I thought, what a great detective. Here's a guy who had a traumatic brain injury. He was a football player, big hulking guy. The injury gave him perfect recall, changed his personality, made him a completely different person. And now he's a detective. And I have all this baggage that I can work with, the traumatic stuff about, him never being able to forget him in the bad memories, and him having the ability to be able to see something so clearly and pristinely that he can figure out stuff that other people can't. It was just a lot of great material to work with. So I think a lot of the characters come from just subject matters that I'm fascinated with. And then I take the subject matters and take bits and pieces and imbue them onto characters that I create for these series books. And it fulfills a lot of, desires of mine. I want to write about things that I'm really interested in. And all the characters that I write about, they do things that I'm interested in.
From your debut book, Absolute Power, in 1996, up to now with Redemption in 2019, you write these interesting stories where real people find themselves in complicated scenarios, like Absolute Power. What would happen if someone oversees the president doing something, and how do they deal with that? And then all of the implications of all of the people that are tied up, in the president's orbit, and all of the fallout that goes from there. When you got to Memory Man, this is more of a real detective story. Did that just scratch something for you that had been itching since you were a kid reading those early mystery stories?
Oh, I think it absolutely did. I mean, in addition to like the three investigators, the first time I ever read a Sherlock Holmes story, it was a speckled band. It was in a Reader's Digest condensed book with some illustrations. And I remember, never heard of Sherlock Holmes before. I think I was in sixth grade, and I opened this Reader's Digest condensed book, and there was a speckled band story. And I was like, oh my gosh, I hope this guy's written something else. And much to my pleasure, Conan Doyle had. And so I read all of those, and I also, big Agatha Christie, Hercule Poirot and Jane Marple are two of my favorite detectives. So I naturally gravitated to that. So for me, it was just sort of right in my sweet spot of things that I really liked, mysteries, detectives, thrillers, clues, people hunting for justice, hunting for criminals. That's what I really loved.
Yeah. When the first Memory Man book, Memory Man, came out, I was intrigued by this power that he had to have a full recall and never forget anything. And at first glance, you think, well, how in the world do you keep this character from just being a Mary Sue where he just, it can solve anything and nothing ever is a challenge to him because he has total recall. But you make it really interesting, because he can't forget anything. Good, bad, indifferent, everything is just inundating him constantly, this information. Was that something that when you're developing that character that you saw as a strong storytelling point, that you could play this ability against him in a way?
Absolutely. And it had to have that sort of that push pull. And I didn't want him to be considered, infallible and vulnerable. He's very vulnerable in many ways. And he always has this dark shadow over him of reliving these horrible memories over and over again and knowing that he's never going to be free of them. That's quite frightening. And the second point, I started this out a little bit in the last book, Memory Man book, The Fallen, where all of a sudden they're like chinks in his memory armor, where all of a sudden they're little hiccups along the way where the memory's not as perfect as it used to be. And that's exacerbated in this novel where he starts to forget something here and there. And that's to show readers that when you suffer a TBI, traumatic brain injury, your brain continues to evolve and change in ways that you can't understand, comprehend, or even stop. You can't control it. So he comes to understand that he may wake up, the next day not having a perfect memory. He may wake up being a totally different person, personality-wise, because his traumatic brain injury changed who he was. He used to be outgoing and gregarious and fun-loving and prankish. And then after his injury, he became aloof and he couldn't understand societal cues. He had difficulty talking with people, interacting with them. And so tomorrow, Amos Decker may, he may be back to being who he used to be with no memory like that at all. So that puts you on pins and needles. But for me as a writer, that provided such great dramatic material to broaden his character other than just this perfect memory recalling detective machine. Because after a while, that would get very old. I want to show his vulnerabilities to people. The fact that just because you have a perfect memory doesn't mean you're going to be able to solve everything. People could lie to you. So the perfect memory doesn't tell you whether the person's lying or not. You just remember exactly what the person said. And people have to keep in mind that Decker's been a policeman and detective for over 20 years. So it's not just he has a perfect memory as his only tool. It's only arrow in his quiver. He's got a lot of experience investigating and figuring out who's lying and who's not lying and figuring out what criminals do and how to catch them. So that's the other, big tool that he has in his arsenal. He's been doing this a long time and he's gotten really good at it.
Amos encounters some really interesting characters throughout his series and some interesting scenarios that you put him in. With this latest book, Redemption, we get to see him in the midst of some really interesting situations and some big themes that we're dealing with in this book. Tell us what Amos finds himself in and how did this story start unfolding for you?
He goes back to Burlington, Ohio, his hometown, where he lived and worked for a long time, raised his family. For a very somber occasion, both his wife and his daughter were murdered in a case that was connected to Amos Decker that you find out about in the first novel, Memory Man. He goes back because this would have been his daughter's 14th birthday. He went back to pay his respects and visit her at the cemetery. The only person with him is Alex Jameson, who's now a full-fledged FBI agent. They've worked together for a long time. And while he's paying respects to his family, out of the tree line of the cemetery on this quiet evening in Ohio comes this old man. And he walks up to Decker. Decker doesn't know who he is. Jameson's kind of nervous. She has no idea who this guy is either. He introduced himself as Merle Hawkins, and that's a name that Decker knows really well. Merle Hawkins was the first person Decker ever arrested for murder when he was a rookie homicide detective back in Burlington. Hawkins is out of prison now for reasons that will be explained in the novel, but he presents an interesting challenge to Decker. He says, look, guess what? You got it wrong. I was innocent. So I'm here today to ask you, one, to prove my innocence, and two, to show everybody that you were wrong. Will you accept the challenge? And Decker being Decker, he does. And it's interesting because most cold cases are done by different teams. The first investigators that did it however many years ago, and then a cold case comes up because it wasn't solved. And you have other people to come in and investigate and see what the investigators did the first time around to see if they made mistakes or whatever. Here, you have a case that was solved. A person was arrested and convicted and sent to prison. And you have the same investigator going back and investigating himself. And that would be Amos Decker investigating Amos Decker to see how he might have screwed up on this case. So for me, it was kind of like taking the old cold case scenario, which everybody knows, and you know, all the books written about it and TV shows, and then flipping it entirely on its head, because this is not an unsolved case. It was solved. And the guy looking at it to see if there was a mistake is not a different person. It's the same guy. So for me, that was just a cool scenario that I don't think had ever been done before.
Well, and it allows us to look at some real hot button issues right now. We've got, you know, a man who claims to be innocent. There are some really high profile cases that have come into the pop culture kind of zeitgeist, where we're now a lot of people are talking about false imprisonment or you know, people being convicted wrongly and then what we do about that as a society, and you know, what is the responsibility of a police officer, and then when you have an officer here who is investigating himself, that leads to some really interesting possibilities about what do we think about justice? How do we swallow our own pride to admit that maybe we did or didn't make a mistake, or maybe we're being accused of making a mistake and we didn't? You know, there's a lot of complexity in that. Were some of these big themes on your mind when you started writing the story?
They absolutely were. I mean, there are a lot of ethical challenges that goes on in the storyline that I've set up in Redemption. When you go back and you try to reopen a case, you have a lot of obstacles going into it. One, people don't want to reopen the case. If a person was convicted, there was enough evidence, reasonable doubt. He had his day in court. The jury found him guilty. End of story. He appealed. Done. So he's just, it is what it is. So when you go back and you try to reopen some of these cases, you know, first of all, people get the hairs up on the back of their neck and they're kind of like, well, you're trying to say we made a mistake. And so that's always, you know, interesting. But at the same time, the end goal should be justice. And I think we have to cut some slack for some of the institutions way back when a lot of these crimes were committed and DNA was not even available. There was no testing, no analysis going back in like the 70s, 60s, 70s, and even into the 80s. So there was not even a possibility to do a DNA analysis. And you see a lot of the prisoners who, you know, have been in prison a long time getting out now because DNA analysis rules them out as being, you know, involved in the crime at all. And their lives have obviously been changed and destroyed. And sometimes they get out of prison and they're not given any, you know, compensation for it. And they're set off after being inside for 30 years until, you know, go have a good rest of your life with no help or support at all. So that certainly is wrong. And then there are some cases where, you know, the people actually got it right and the person was guilty and, you know, they're where they should be. But opening those cases up is really difficult. Because nobody wants to, the initial human reaction is say, oh, you're trying to tell me I made a mistake. And I don't think that I did. And so we're not going to go there. And the barriers, I mean, I was a trial lawyer for 10 years. The barriers to try to overturn somebody's decisions, it's really, really difficult, particularly if a long period of time has passed and judges aren't that sympathetic to people. And so they are much more prone to say, you know, denied. We're not going to look at this. If there was a problem, there was a mess up, it didn't rise high enough for reversible error, so their person's going to stay in prison. And you hope at that point the person is guilty, because if they're innocent, what a horrendous, you know, outcome. But it's, you know, it is something. And, you know, for me, no system is perfect. But on a human level, I would have to say that one innocent person being in prison is one person too many. Because I can't imagine it any more horrible than being behind bars for something that you didn't do.
Yeah. How do Decker's unique abilities help or hinder him in a situation like this?
I think that one thing that helps him is that he can recognize conflicts, contradictions, and misstatements instantly. Because, you know, as he said, and I updated the terminology in the first Amos Decker book, he called it his own personal DVR. He would just spool up film and he can look at it. Now, I think in this book, I refer to it as him downloading from his cloud. You know, I want to be modern in all my lingo.
Love it.
So he's able to sort of, to put a template over stuff. So if somebody told him something the next day, he remembers exactly what the person said. If they tell him something different on X2 day, then immediately it clicks and he understands there's a problem there. Now, sometimes, you know, memories, again, he only has a perfect memory. So if somebody lies to him, he doesn't know whether that's true or not. He doesn't know that it's a lie just because he has a perfect memory. He just remembers what the person says. And if they don't say anything else that contradicts them, he's as helpless as anybody else in trying to figure out whether the person was lying or not. In this case, I think the fact that he was a rookie homicide detective, he was able to be manipulated, even with his perfect memory, a little bit more than he would have been now after having 20 years under his belt doing this kind of work. And he fixated on some stuff that all of us would say, that's pretty conclusive. There's forensic details in the case with Merle Hawkins that you would look at, and any detective would say, case closed, you did it, you're done, that's it. And in this case, you know, it may not turn out to be that way. You couldn't fault him for why he concluded what he did. But as you read through the book, you understand that he comes down hard on himself, saying that I should have seen this, I should have seen that, I shouldn't have done that, I should have focused on this and not that. And it really bothers him that he blew it. So for me, it was a learning experience for Decker. And also for the reader, understanding that just perfect recall doesn't mean perfect in all respects. He's a human being, and he fails and he falls down and makes mistakes like we all do.
Right. Looking back over your back catalog and beginning with Absolute Power in 1996, you went through several years where you released one book a year, and which is the schedule that most authors are on. Most people release one big book a year, and then they may have some small projects sprinkled around, but for the most part, you have had amazing success with your books, and you know, by any accounts, this could be a time that you could slow down, put out one book a year, and everybody would be completely happy that they got the new David Baldacci book. But you, your pace is becoming almost frenetic as you're publishing. You know, with the latest Vega Jane book out just a couple months ago, and now Redemption, and then I think you have a book coming out this summer and one this fall.
Yep.
How do you keep up with such a tense schedule like that?
Yeah, I mean, you're right in saying that probably the last 10 years I've had two books a year. This year was an anomaly that the Vega Jane book had been done for a while and Scholastic scheduled it for publication, you know, earlier this year. The summer book was just a freak thing. You know, I love crime noir, and I was going to write a short story while I was on tour last year for Long Road to Mercy, just a short story that maybe they might publish as an e-book about this guy, post-World War II, came back from the war, falsely in prison, got out of prison, and has to serve his parole in this town, little small town in the middle of nowhere, and things go incredibly wrong and badly for him. And it's a mystery and kind of a thriller, but set in the 1940s, and written in a crime noir sort of way, which is a style that I love. And, you know, Raymond Chandler, I think, was one of the greatest prose artists we've ever had.
Oh, yeah.
You could say, you know, maybe his plots weren't the greatest in the world, but I don't really care about the plots. I love the dialogue. I love the prose. I love the narrative. But I was so obsessed over it. I wrote. And by the end of the day, I had 400 pages. It was a novel. And my publisher had no idea I was even writing. I didn't even know I wasn't writing a novel. I was writing a short story. And so when I sent it up to them, they were like, oh my God, you know, this is fantastic stuff. And they asked for a 2-book deal for this character. And I was like, great. But again, I just sit down and write a story, and then sometimes it takes me in unexpected directions. And so I was doing an event with John Grisham down in Florida. We were doing a luncheon together up on stage, and he was asking me, he goes, my God, you know, you got to turn in all these books. And I said, well, but sometimes you don't anticipate. There's no schedule. I didn't say 2019 I was going to have 4 books. I had no idea I was going to have 4 books. But for me, I love to write. And when I'm done with one, I just jump onto another. I don't take a break because I feel like my whole life is a break. I mean, I get to do what I love to do for a living. What could be better than that? And I think that's one reason why I am prolific. It's just because it sounds cliche. I don't mean it to be, and I don't feel it this way. I really love to write. If I'm not working on a story, I'm just not a happy guy. I feel like there's a huge void in my life. And so I think that's why the books keep flowing.
Do characters keep coming back up to you? Does Amos tell you, okay, David, it's time for another story? Or, do the schedule of books, is it because there's a particular publishing schedule, or is it because these characters have another story to tell and they bug you about?
Yeah, there's no publishing schedule for that. It really is what character resonates with me. Who do I want to write about? What do I feel strongly that I have more to say about a particular character? And that's what drives me. That's why, you know, one year it might be a John Puller, one year it might be a Will Robey, one year it might be an Amos Decker that I want to bring back. Right now, you know, Atlee Pine was a brand new book last year with a new character. I'm working on a new one for her and really excited about that. It's all about, you need to be excited when you're sitting down to write a book. You want excitement and fun to flow through in the pages. If it's a drudge for you to write it, it's going to be a drudge to read it. And, you know, I don't want that. So I have to bring excitement and fun. When I go and talk to aspiring writers, I say, look, it's hard work, and you're going to have down days and up days where you nail it, and some days you fall below what you wanted to do. But I said, please don't forget to have fun. I know that it's a job. I know that you make your living from it, but don't treat it like you're going to a factory working on an assembly line doing the same widget every day, because it's going to kill you. You know, the creativity is just going to fall right out of you. You got to have fun, because that fun will come through in the pages.
When we all got into this to have fun and to tell stories that meant something to us, and if you're not doing that, then I don't know what
to do. Go find something else
is
to do for a living.
Exactly. Well, the new book, Redemption, the fifth in the Memory Man series. I love this series. I love this character so much, David. It's out, available everywhere now in hardback, audiobook, Kindle edition. Any way that you read books, you can get the latest book, Redemption. David, plug your website, if you would, to tell people where they can find all the good stuff that you're doing.
Yep. You can go to davidbaldacci.com, and that ties into the wishyouwellfoundation.org. It also ties into the Facebook and Twitter and Instagram accounts. So everything's there for you.
Excellent. David, thank you so much for taking time to come back on the show.
I always enjoy it. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the show. Go to hankgarner.com to subscribe. Now stay tuned for a special audiobook clip from Master of Hounds from C. Stephen Manley.
He met Clint's eyes for the first time, and for an instant they flared with a dark violet light, like something you'd see lighting up fluorescent paints in a nightclub. Clint gasped suddenly, despite himself, and took another few steps back. He turned to run, blood bag scraping along behind him, when a chorus of howls from the floors below brought him up short. He stopped and looked around, fighting hard to keep his fear under control. "Be glad you parked near the top," the man said. "I told my hounds to start at the bottom and work their way up, while I came in from above. If you'd encountered them instead of me, you'd be in pieces by now." Clint was sure he could make it to either the stairwell that would lead him back inside or the elevator that would take him down to the garage's ground level. He'd have to stop at either, though, whether to try and pull a door open or wait for the elevator car. He glanced to the side as flashes of police robes started lighting up the night beyond the parking deck, and sirens grew louder. He heard the distant chop-chop of a helicopter's rotors. "Don't get your hopes up," the man said. "All the Pikmin are dead, and my hounds will make short work of the police. You're trapped, son. Face it like a man." Clint thought it over for a second before he realized that the man was right. No matter which way he went, he would get run down before he had a chance to get clear. There was no way out, and that meant there was only one thing left to do. He drew in a deep breath, knelt, and placed the patient on the floor as gently as he could. Fear-driven breath hissed around his teeth as he turned and faced the man in the stained suit. "I'm not your son," he said, meeting the other's eyes and planting his feet. The man's eyebrows rose in surprise. "Excuse me?" Clint swallowed hard. "You heard me, Slim. I'm not your son, and if you're looking to hurt this guy, well, we have a problem if that's the case." The man's eyes had grown wide with disbelief as Clint had been talking. After a moment, a wide smile crossed his face. Let me make sure I understand, he said, holding up a hand for Clint to wait. You've met my hounds. You just saw me throw that female around like she was a lawn dart, and now you're standing between me and my prey, even though it's obvious from your face that you have no earthly idea what I am or what you're actually facing. Have I got that all right? Clint swallowed again. His mouth was as dry as a desert wind. I think that about sums it up. The dark light flared through the man's eyes again, and tiny arcs of the same colored electricity danced over his hands. Give me the Pikmin, the man said, his voice suddenly more animal than man. Clint's stomach tightened as his guts went cold. For just an instant, he almost ran, but the moment passed, and he shifted his hands and feet into a defensive stance. He forced himself to hold the other man's black light stare as he shook his head. Suddenly, the lights were gone from the man's eyes as though they'd never been there. Really? He said. Usually that little display sends you humans running like rabbits. It's been decades since anyone stood up to me like this. Why would you? You must recognize that I can kill you as easy as sliding off a horse. Why would you risk that for someone you've just met? He can't possibly be anything to you. He's my patient, Clint said, forcing the words past the lump in his throat. He's mine to look after until he's well. That, and I made a promise. Besides, you said it yourself. I'm boxed in here. If this is where I go out, then I'm sure as hell not going to do it running. The man studied Clint through narrowed eyes, his smile dropping into a thoughtful line. You would die for a promise. Son, that makes you a rarity in today's world. He raised a finger to his lips absently, as though considering his options, and then said, I'll tell you what. Since you've shown some obvious courage, I'll make you a deal. You walk away unmolested by either myself or my hounds. Gone, free and clear to live out as long a life as you can manage. Only you, though. The Pikmin stays with me. Even Clint was surprised by how fast he replied. No deal, freak show. This man's under my protection. The man with the blacklight eyes shook his head thoughtfully. A rarity indeed, he said. It's very nearly a shame to kill you. The man studied him a moment longer, then shrugged and said, Oh well, omelets and eggs. Energy flared around his hands and he thrust them toward Clint. Clint saw the hands coming up, the dark energy crackling between them. At the same time, though, he felt someone grab his ankle from behind. Warmth, like walking from a cold room into a hot summer day, flooded through him. At the same moment, searing pain seemed to light up his chest and head. For an instant, everything went dark. He felt as though he were being shredded apart from the inside out and pulled into a trillion molecule-sized lines that stretched out into a black forever. He had no throat to scream with, or eyes to weep with, or limbs to defend himself with. For that instant, he was little more than a stain of pain and terror stretched across the world. Then, the instant was over. Clint didn't feel himself fall, didn't feel the concrete bite into his face, didn't hear the sobbing scream that rushed from his throat. In those last instants before the darkness came for him again and his vision was clear, all he saw was his patient rising to his feet and stepping past him.